to get close to one another. And you have no idea that you are the least girl ever going to Palomar College. And he said, you can't be afraid of being alone. To know what to say, to know what to do, to have fun together, and I did not know how to join their shoulders, and we sang, and it was wonderful, and I blacked out. If only I had a good education, then I could be happy. So I proceeded to obtaining. 3 or 4 days later, I got a call from this lady that it was time for me to come and pick up my stuff to live. And the only time when I ever felt comfortable or had people dying, I did not know what to do. I had given life my... And while he was having them stop, because it's after that I get into all this trouble. That morning on June 21st, 19th, rarely have we seen a person fail. So the odds are as good as they get. I'm a lover. What can I say? I love quickly. Of course, there is the elation, fair job, and the patience to wait for it. That same week, last week, the steps you will be taking next week have nothing to do with today. To start opening an eye, and I'm beginning to entertain negative, mean, destructive thoughts about people. I can never be happy. How can I possibly go to a party ever again? Well, I will tell you, if you call your other little kids, how about me? I thought I had fallen through the cracks. Dogs downtown. And I had still, they are the flowers of my sobriety.
I've been in show business. Your introduction was the most recent. What else can I say about it, you know? He told my first two jokes, and I told him how dare he comes in here and tells them. It ruins the whole opening. I'm glad there's a moat here so you can't get to me. I was in vaudeville, and this kind of reminds me, you know, of a vaudeville theater. And I used to work with a pig. Not that kind of a pig. I see the woman going, is that what he means? This kind of pig? I didn't know he was wearing. No, I had a contract that I had to leave the stage the way I found it. And the pig was there to eat whatever people threw at me. That's not funny, but I wound up a good act. I had three pigs. That's the way it was. I'm sure that there's many of you here who have been... Are you going to sit down? Go ahead. It's a real short guy down here. We've all been, many of us, DWI. I was DOA. Drunk on animal. Literally. One Sunday morning I got up, got my best horse. He'd touch him with one knee, and he'd go this way, go that way, go this way. I went to a guy's house way out, about 10 miles from where I lived. I knew he had some. I went in, drank till noon, had a horse because I had a cowboy suit on. And here's the horse going, huh? And I thought, why ride up to the woods? Right up the main highway, right? Right up the turnpike. Why not? I fall, I pass out. Oh, the horse is going this way, this way, this way, this way, this way. This way. Pull over a horse. I said, officer, he's been eating fermented oats. But I didn't know. And they arrested me. I tried to tell my wife that I did it just for the heck of it. Didn't go over. Yesterday morning is my want when I have a day off. I go to a place called the Holden Arboretum in near where I live. It's beautiful. 3,000 acres of trees and lakes and wildlife. And I fished a little bit, took some pictures, and I'm sitting there, and There is no age. I had no age. I was just me. And I was thinking solely about now. That moment. And right now, I am thinking and living now. What a beautiful thing it is to live right now. If you will think of yourself as a little heavier than you are, and I don't care how much you weigh, think of right now, this minute being the most important minute and moment of your life, because you're living it. It is now. Right now, tomorrow, you know that. There's nothing you can do about tonight. You can plan. You can dream a little, but think of now. It's simpler. You breathe easier. If you want to, you can laugh if you want to, but now, how lovely now is. When I was expelled, I only knew about nows. I lived in that present moment, as all children do. You live in them, in that moment you're in. It's so lovely. You realize the mornings. You realize the rain, the day, your bed, your home. How lovely that moment, that now is. And you go back, and when you think of yesterdays, you should only think about them. Those nows were the first sunset, the first time you saw an airplane, so many firsts, the first fish you caught, the first girl you ever saw that was beautiful. I didn't know when I was born. I didn't know when my father died a little later than I lived with 9 different families. I didn't know there was something within me, within sight of me, some very sinister in me, waiting silently, very cunning, sitting there. I didn't know about that because I thought of only now. And they were nice. I didn't realize that I was 6 feet tall, weighed 98, teeth sticking straight out, and had asthma. I lived in a little town of 4,000, Norwalk, Ohio. You'd ring on the phone like, just, "Hello, Ruth, I'm sick." You couldn't get a date when you were that tall and you had asthma, 3 feet sticking straight out. I'd no more say their word. They'd know it was me with the wheezing, you know. I go, "Hello, Marilyn, I'm sick." Strange thing about that town, all the girls were sick. All the time. You go to the high school dance, they had a wonderful drug there. I don't know what it was. All mothers had it. I'd get there and they'd say, "My mother gave me something. I'm all right now." I gotta tell you, it had nothing to do with age, but I was living with one family, and it was a doctor by the name of Dietz, and he said they'd never, in the state of Ohio, straighten any kid's teeth. And he said, "If you pay for the hardware, $200, I'll straighten this boy's teeth." So I got all the stuff in there. Now I got a little identity. People are going, "Let's see that radio, Lynn." And they go, "Ha, ha, ha, ha." You know. And they had, there was a girl, prettiest girl. Oh, I think, well, maybe, you know. I call up, "Hello, Rose. Will you go to the Moose Theater?" She said, "Yes." "Oh, I'm 13 years old. I know what it is. I know what we're talking about. I've kissed a pillow for 2 years. I got a date, man." We go to the theater and I tell her the ending before we get there. Because I didn't want to wait, because she said I could kiss her goodnight. Well, we get on the fork. And I laid him with me. And you know the little hooks on the front? Yeah, we got hooked. And she said, her father, he's coming in. She says, We better go to Dr. D. You know, we talked about Clinton. We better go to Dr. Teacher's house. I said, I think he moved to Pittsburgh. Let's go. I want to stay that way for the rest of my life. But I just began to realize he wasn't going to die of malnutrition. I... Explain it to him, will you? We started walking up the street. We passed two people, and they said, the kids today. We were hooked together. I see her once in a while, and we go out and get hooked again. It's nice. Dirty minds. But I didn't know about my identity. I just enjoyed the nows. I enjoyed the moments. I enjoyed... You go out and go, yeah, there he is. Isn't that beautiful? How lovely a now is, a present moment, this moment that we are living in. There's some illness. It'll go away or it won't. You have a choice. You can worry about it or just live this moment. I was living with one Greek family. I came in. I was about 14 years old. I was staying there. They had some mastika. Looked like water. I was hot. What? Mastika. Woo! 298 pounds. The toughest kid that ever walked the block. Oh, I found out. He took the braces, the guy that hit me. I got in a fight with somebody, the guy that hit me, took the braces and the three teeth out. I began to drink hard cider. I began to drink home brew. Where's your relatives? I had brothers and sisters, but they had lives of their own. They were much older than I was. My mother died in childbirth. They were born out of the country in Salisbury, England. And immediately when people started asking me about my family, all of this that was waiting inside came about. Poor me. I didn't have them. Two, I have a right to drink. I have a right to drink so that I... And I had forgotten something in this moment and how beautiful it was. It used to be the Wheeling and Lake Erie Railroad there, and I'd hear the whistle, and I'd say, someday I'm going to go there, and I'm going to become somebody. I won't worry about the drinking now. And even at that age, I woke up, I remember they woke me up in the bank building doorway in the morning. I was asked to leave school once because I had been drinking. I continued to drink. I got out of school. I had two very close friends. I hitchhiked. I took a banjo. One family had a banjo, and I taught myself to play it. I started playing in... Then you didn't need to belong to a union. I started playing in any club that I... Any town I was in. I hitchhiked about 30 states of this... beautiful United States, but I didn't see any of this United States. All I saw was those roadhouses. I would sleep in the back. I would sleep in the Salvation Army. I would sleep in the police station. I'm sure I've been in as many police stations as anybody here. Either I was sleeping or I was arrested. One of the two. I kept playing banjo. I went clear down the Florida Keys. I went up to New Orleans. I remember coming into Joplin, Missouri. And the guy is years old, and I'm drunk. I get out. I could still play banjo. And they would give you free drinks. And that's why I played the banjo and sang old songs just to drink. I was playing at Fred Harvey's Brass. And I met a writer by the name of William Saroyan. He was going to MGM. He took me with him. I went there, got a stock contract for $10,000. At the middle of 1939. I am saying to you that $10,000 at that time, and in 1940, was absolutely a lot of money. Now I'm at MGM. They had a commissary. They had banking. They had barbershops. You could live there. And I stayed there. They had bars there. 25 miles square. Nothing but beautiful starlets. Nothing but famous people. And I was drinking with the best of them. I would go in the bar, and there was literally, and I'm not name dropping, there'd be Spencer Tracy, Clark Gable, Robert Taylor, Red Skelton, you name them. The big stars, they were in there, and I was sitting there going, "Hi, my name's Lynn Sheldon, how are you?" I didn't have a mother or father, and I can drink because things have been really tough for me, but I made it. They didn't give me too many parts. Because I really didn't try that hard. I kept feeling sorry for myself. I didn't realize that I had a choice. One, I could have chosen right then and there to take whatever career I was going to have and make something out of it. Or continue to drink. Do you know that every time we get up in the morning, right now, you have it, you're living in now. I hope you're still thinking about now. This moment, and you have a choice. You can go to sleep, you are in front of you, but it is now. You have a choice, and when you get up tomorrow morning, do you want coffee, you want to put sugar in it, want to put cream, what kind of eggs do you want? Oh, are you making a choice with your friends? If you let your emotion, that's simple. That choice. If I had to let my intellect decide what I was going to do, then I could have stayed on at MGM, went back there after the war, and who knows, I would have tried. But by this time, I was being consumed, my intellect was consumed by alcohol, it was gone. And my emotions were bubbling over with poor me. I was making the wrong choices. Even in the army, I made wrong choices. I drank. I have nobody to love me. I have nobody to care. I am alone. People don't know what I have seen. I was making the wrong choice. I wasn't thinking of now, and I wasn't using my intellect. Those three things were now are so important to me. How bad was it? A fifth a day. Every day. Every single day. Beer. Case of beer. Two drinks. All right, I'll just go to wine. A little wine for dinner. I ate dinner at 9 o'clock in the morning. Two quarts of wine. So I didn't have dinner. Now it has become the main focus of my life, to drink. I found out about sodium amytal. I got doctors to prescribe it. I was taking sodium amytal, lots of it. How bad? A friend of mine and I, after the war, he and I had been friends, came home, we got drunk, we decided which one was in the tougher group. I was in the infantry and he was in the paratroopers. I didn't realize how serious. You got the guts to do it? We were both drunk. Sure. You? Yes. Flipped the coin, he got it first. Put the pistol in his mouth, blew his head off. I cried. I said, "This is God. Where?" I'm glad I take him out of the back, say, "Hey, God, help me." I felt a little better, put the spare tire back in the trunk of my mind, in the back of my mind. I wanted so much to make the whole world change. Everybody has to change for one Lynn Sheldon. I didn't realize that I had to change. After that, feeling sorry for my friend dying, I cleaned up. His mother came home. What could we say? I won't go through that whole business. I went down to Cincinnati with another guy in a drunken bash 2 weeks later. We went down there. He was going to pick up a girl at a wedding party. It was on a Saturday night. She was going to get married the following Saturday. We went in. All the silverware and gifts were there. I went up to the girl who was going to be married the following Saturday. Talked her into going out. Got her drunk. We got married in Kentucky on Monday. Came back and her family was mad. I don't know why. The guy she was going to marry was mad. So the family annulled it. What a terrible thing to do to me. Poor me. How often have we all said, poor me? How often have we said, I have no choice? I don't want to live in the present. One thing alcohol and drugs do to you is you go, hey, this is wonderful, man. Right now, look at that little spot there. Hey, that's marvelous. Somebody comes in and says, your house is on fire. I bet it's a great blaze. It's really burning. You're living in the present moment, but you can do it without it. Now, I kept drinking. I was playing a nightclub in Cleveland called the Alpine Village. A man came up to me and said, we're opening it. I had, again, married again, 2 children, and we're working in, and I'm working Cicero, Illinois. Yeah. I'm up in a bar in Cicero, and a guy says, I'm doing my route. 6 guys at the bar in the gray hats, and the one guy says, make them laugh, Ralph. And he goes up and he takes out a .38 and puts it in my head. Says, be funny. I was a riot. You ever see a guy faint? Right there. They went, ha, 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 ha. I didn't go back that night. I finished that show and went out. But I was working with big acts. I worked in many clubs with big acts. Jackie Gleason, George Gobles, and people like that. I did a comedy act. You wouldn't realize it now. Chuck stole all the material. But I kept drinking. Working in the nightclub in Cleveland, a man came up to me and said, we're opening a television station, the first one between New York and Chicago. This is 1947. We had 2 children. My wife said, look, we could get an apartment just for, and I said, 6 months. All right. It'll be 38 years ago, December 19th. I've been on the air at least Dallas and Washington. My show was on NBC for a number of years. I have a children's show called Barnaby. A children's show. Would you believe that? A drunk having a children's show? Hi there, kids. Boy. Drink their milk. Drink this milk. Oh, boy, that's good. Drink 8 ounces of water every day. Oh, see what it makes me strong. You're the one that wrote those letters, too, aren't you? Downtown in Cleveland, in a place called the Auditorium Hotel, room 510, faced a street called St. Clair. And do you know that I would call my wife, now the 3rd child is here, I am going to Washington. Is anybody writing this down? We got this. Not bad material, you gotta keep that. Hotel, I would call my wife, say I'm busy. Overnight working, extra sodium amytal. One night, I drank. My God, they're coming again. Well, but it's a nice fire. I took so much sodium amytal, so much booze I've been drinking all day, and I could work that program so I could just feel level enough to get through it and then get out. And I was getting somewhere near 30,000 letters a month from children. And they're, yes, I'm that nice person up there. At least the children know it, but the adults don't know it. The world doesn't know it. Help me. I had taken so many pills one night and so much booze, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I go out and I start walking up 6th Street, and I fell. Some police were there. They took me to the hospital. A doctor was coming out. He cut my throat in the lawn. 3 days later, I come to. I got a tracheotomy. He's standing there, and he said, "Sir, you had about 25 seconds to live. I've never seen anybody get so close to death that didn't die." All that alcohol, all of that sodium amytal, Thorazine, everything. I would pick a pill up off the street and take it. Now, I felt so bad. I almost died. Poor Lynn. No mother, no father. I almost died. I didn't even know him, and I almost died. Now, my wife, the mother of my children, wakes up one morning and has double vision. We quickly go to the hospital. She has 2 inoperable tumors. It isn't long before she dies. I have 3 children again. Poor me. How sorry I am. I drank. I gambled. I can't tell you because there are women and children and some nice men here. Everything I did. Boy. In jail, many jails, and they would allow me to get out. NBC would pay to get me out. They would send attorneys. They would quiet it. They would buy off reporters. The next thing I know, I am offered by CBS through an agent $3 million for 3 years, $3 million for 9 years. We went to New York. I couldn't drink without getting it. I couldn't get on a plane without drinking, because if it was going down, I didn't want to die drunk or die sober, because I never liked the people on the plane. I used to say, I don't want to die with these people. I don't even know them. We got an agent, makes the deal. You got to come in tomorrow and sign. I was so thrilled. We could go in the next day and sign the contract. I woke up and I was on a boat off the dear friend of mine at Rosary Hall telling me that he woke up on a boat one time. But I woke up. This is a big yacht. And I don't mean a front or back yacht. I mean a yacht. Get out of this bed, and I go out, and there's a small bar. There's a guy behind a bar and a guy sitting at the other, maybe about 6 stools, and it's beautiful, big boat, guys with suits, you know. I said to the guy, "There's a nice boat." And the other guy said, I said, "Whose is it?" Anybody want to guess whose boat that is? Yeah. So you rented it, Mrs. Sheldon.
Oh, yeah. Right. Right.
They've got tapes of me going on now all of this time.
Hi, boys and girls.
You know. Barnaby is the name of the character. So I said to the man,
I guess I must have invited you to come aboard. Was one of my goals. So I said, now I've had a few. How did you get on my boat?
He said, I'm the pilot that flew you down here. You remember when you rented the plane? Yeah, I remember the plane.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that plane. Oh, yeah, that plane. Oh, yeah, that plane. Did that cost? I came back. CBS didn't want me. I don't know why. I've been gone a month. Only a month. They didn't want me. NBC says, you better straighten out. You know, I had them going to other guys. I had him crying.
You poor thing. I didn't know that.
They'd give me Sony Mammothol IVs, you know, and I thought that was wonderful. And I had four or five of them giving me, writing me prescriptions, and they, I spent, I can't tell you how much to psychiatrists. I know they're all living well. So are all my ex-wives. Bless their hearts, I hurt them. Yes, I married again. In the nows that we have as children, you failed. If you dream of being in that bus for 3 years and the base is loaded, that's all. You don't dream of just any girl. You dream of the prettiest girl in the world, some movie star, some lovely person. It's all veiled, and I kept dreaming all of this, but it was never coming around. But all of these ladies that I was married to were just lovely in here. They lived in the present moment, and I gave them a terrible time. I am in that room 5:10 one night. My third divorce. I've drank everything there. I've got a slash across here. I can show it to you. There's no more booze. There's no more pills. There's no more drugs. But I have a great large bottle of Vitalis. And I drank it. I went over to a louvered screen and went like that and opened it, and there were camels down in the street, and I screamed and jumped back because I had had audio DTs. I had had shakes. I'd been strapped down many times. I'd been in video and visual and muscular DTs. This is the first time I ever saw camels. And they weren't cigarettes either. They were there, man. Beautiful place called Rosary Hall. Later, I found out, it used to be a place in Cleveland called the Arena. It's gone now. The last time the Ringling Brothers played the Arena, in order to get the animals there, they had to unload them down by the terminal tower and take them up St. Clair past that hole. And I opened the Louvered screen. Those were real camels. So they get me in all 3 days. I thought they had white bellhops, the beautiful nuns that I dearly love. One, Sister Victorine, that I see still, not hooray for me, but she's so dear to my heart. I listened. I went to the meetings that they had in Rosary Hall, and I had one, yeah, I got to tell you this, had one, there was one drawer I'd open, and I'd hear an orchestra playing. Every time I'd do audio, they play requests. And not, I got to tell you this, I'm just, it's just so, such a lovely place. And I'm sitting there talking, this is true, sitting there, we got to laugh at ourselves. I'm telling this man who's in bed that I was in that very bed. And I said, do you know something? And he said, no, what? $417, that ain't bad for one night, I'll tell you that. I'll split it with you. I said to this guy, when I was in your bed, I'd open that drawer, and they would... And I said, but I don't hear it now. And this poor soul, who had just come into Rosary Hall, said, do you know why not? And I said, no. He said, because it's in the refrigerator. I said, oh, it was there. I still hadn't got it all out of my system. But I still was not living in the now. I still was not making the right choices. I was still allowing my emotions to rule my life. I had
F-E-A-R-S.
I'm not bright. I just said I could spell. Face the fact that you have a fear. E, evaluate the situation. A, action, muscle action. Do something about it. I have learned that this is one thing that has helped me. If I have a problem that I cannot solve, I go out and polish my car, I scrub the floor, I get out, I go for a walk, I work out, I'm 65 years old, I do workouts in my gym, I do it until the thing is gone. Muscle action, get up and do it. Ah, reserves, call on somebody, and S, I went 2 years. I went to meetings. I went to things like this. I listened. I sat there. I said, I'm there. I'm yawning. I'm not paying attention. I'm listening. I read the big book. I knew all the steps, but I didn't do anything. And how cunning, how sinister this inner alcoholism and addiction is waiting. I'm out on a boat again. I'm out on Lake Erie, three of us, I'm on a vacation. It has been 2 years, I haven't had a drink, and one guy says, bring me up a beer. I got up there and he said, I don't want it. Like that. Like that, it dropped. I forgot. I drank it. Before we got back to port, went all over the golf course. Cost me $3,000. To rebuild a part of that golf course. They were mad, I don't know why. I was arrested that night. I continued to drink. My children, my two daughters said goodbye. I was in jail, they came and they one spit in my face and she had a right to. The other said he was 4 years old and he's a gutsy guy. And he said, I'll help you if you'll help yourself. I tried to. I went to Cedar Point one night. I came out. I was so drunk. It was about 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm driving in Sandusky, Ohio, and I can hardly make it. I want to find a place to sleep. I pass a shopping center. There are two state patrolmen. That's all that's in the shopping center, just two state patrolmen. If you're a state patrolman, God bless you. Fine. But I drive in, and I'm in AA. When you're drunk, to take you someplace to sleep, because they'll take you someplace to sleep. They saw me driving, and they had been looking for me, because I'd been speeding. Like most of us, I drove one of two ways, shut off or flat out. Why do we do these things when we are drunk? Why do we try to prove to everybody else that we are the best? I'm the strongest. I'm the most macho guy. I'm the gutsiest guy. Don't tell me. I didn't realize that if somebody says that, that's their problem, not mine. If no one likes what I do, if I say I don't want to do that, and you think I'm a sissy, that's your problem. It isn't mine. And did I do things? You bet. Steamboat Springs, Colorado, I was drunk. I went down, never had been on skis in my life, and I went off that big jump. And made it. And I said, hey, what's this all about, ski jumping? Anybody can do that. You know, the next day you get up and go, oh, boys and girls are in my water. After that arrest, I called my sponsor and I got back in this program. What a beautiful you. I love you. I care for you, an alcoholic or anything else. When you are alone, playing on television to over 1 million homes in one day, you get 33,000 letters that say, I love you. And you go home and you shut that door and you say, hello, and there's no one there. Do I get lonely? No. Because I live right now. I say, isn't it nice to be in my home? I own this home. I have saved my money. I have made something of myself. I live with my intellect. Yes, I have emotions. Sure, I have a right to feel sorry because of the loss of my sister or someone close to me or someone I love. But I can say I am going to allow myself this now to say it is a terrible thing, but this is the way God has meant it to be. And I say I will cope with it. And I will go on and I will cope with it. Three things that I do in my life that this program has given to me. Be careful of that. How do you know that moment might come? If somebody put a gun to my head and said, you either drink or I'm going to pull a trigger. I've got enough self-respect, I'll say pull it. I don't give a damn, pull it. But if they put it in my son's head, or my daughter's, or my grandchildren, would I drink? I don't know. You never know when that moment, it's waiting there. Drugs, it's all waiting. Just live in this moment. That's what I do. I live in now. Every choice I make is my intellect. And if somebody doesn't say to myself, I am doing the correct thing, what I think is right, not emotionally, but intellectually, then that's mine. I live in this now. Yes, I love God. Yes, I know that He is with me. He is within me. Everybody is beautiful. I hear music now, but I make it myself. I love those children. And I've got to tell you that there is humor everywhere. Not too long ago, I've got to tell you this. One of the psychiatrists I went to came to me and said, Barnaby, and that's the character that I play on television for those who've never seen me, which is probably all but Chuck up here. He still watches. He says, you know, he crans. They won't let him use anything sharp or ellipse. Now, I remember I was born in Norwalk, and I've been on 37 years as Barnaby, all right? Now, this psychiatrist said, we have a man in the hospital who is behind locked doors. The poor soul is an emotional, mental case. I'm not making fun of humor and everything. He said, all he does from morning till night is watch television. Watches television. Man about 70. Said, maybe go in and talk to him. Now remember, I'm in a mental hospital behind locked doors. I go in, I sit down, he's just watching TV. I don't know what to say. I'm dressed like this. He says, where are you from? I said, Norwalk, Ohio. He said, you know Barnaby? He's from Norwalk, Ohio. Remember, I'm in a mental hospital behind locked doors. And I said, I'm Barnaby. And all tenderness, he got up, put his arms around me and said, pal, in here you can be anybody you want to. Be anybody I want to. I can be me. For you have given me a lovely moment on now that I shall never forget. God bless you, and I thank you for it. Thank you very much for helping me.
I certainly enjoyed the time that I've been here, immensely so. And I want to tell you a little bit where I come from, and there's a sentence in the third step prayer. And it says, take away my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help. And anything that happens in here is about His power and His love and His way of life. Today I come from a place of what doesn't God do? I didn't wake myself up this morning. I get awakened in the morning. I don't plug into 220 current and some life force begins to move through me. What doesn't God do? I do nothing without the power. There's a line in Bill's story, of myself I am nothing, the Father doeth the works. That's the place I come from today, but that wasn't the place I came to when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a big joke teller, but I heard a couple lately that I want to share. It will lighten things up here a little bit before God takes me wherever he takes me. Several people said to me, you know, good luck. And the thing I love about whenever I'm asked to speak is, see, I only have to do one thing. I went back to my room and I meditated for 15 minutes and I went into the silence. And I asked my loving Father to get me out of the way and do with me as he needs to do with me. And so I come up here with complete faith that he will do that. I don't need luck when I operate on the will of God. I just need to tap into that will. But we have some Al-Anons in here. And she hits a golf ball off into the rough and she goes over to get it. And this little leprechaun comes up to her and says, I'm going to give you 3 wishes. She said, okay. And he said, but there's one condition, and that is that if I give you the wishes, your husband's going to get 10 times whatever you get. She said, well, that's okay. And so he said, well, what's your first wish? And she says, well, I'd like to have $1,000,000. And he said, okay, you've got it, but you know your husband's going to get 10 times that. He says, yeah, and scratch golf. Well, I'll give that to you, but you know your husband's going to be 10 times a golfer. She said, that's fine. That's okay with me. He said, well, you got one wish left. Use it very carefully. What would you like? She said, I'd like to have just a little teeny heart attack. That's exactly what they would have prayed for. And then I got one more. I love picking on drunks because I am one. I'm at peace with being flawed today, but this sums me up too. When your dog and you, when the dog and the alcoholic both walk into the house, what's the difference between the two of them? The dog stops whining. And I have 2 dogs, and that's exactly what happens. They come up to greet me, and I walk in the house, and sometimes there's no one there, and they're happy to be in the house, and I'm just still going on. You know, I got sober in Denver, Colorado in 1982. My sponsor, Don P., who was down here, I believe, last year, told me to pass on his hello and love to all of you. He's moved back up into Colorado again, and I have quite a bit of contact with him. But I was at a convention one time in Denver, and I was sitting with this woman who's been sober a long, long time. She leaves over, and she says to me, I think I want that guy to get sober worse than his family. And I'm not going to talk much about what it was like, and the reason is very simple. The things I did, once I took it, takes you. Some people sit at home and drink, and some go to bars, and some go to the penitentiary, and some wreck. That is not Idaho. We do not raise potatoes. They raise corn back there. Raised in a Norwegian farming community, a friend of mine gave me, it's like, you know, what are you trying to say to me, you know? I love that when members of AA, they'll say something to you and it'll hit you. And it's like your response is, what do you mean by that? And, but I didn't drink till I was 16 years old. I got 3 brothers, and the reason I didn't is I had a dad that died of alcoholism in 1986, and I said that I wasn't ever going to be like him. And I've written up inventory to know that I turned out just like him. And I took a drink of alcohol when I was sick alcohol. And I didn't ask for him to do that. I just asked for help. He had his own idea how he was going to give me that help. And I have 3 brothers today that are dying of alcoholism. And I kind of felt, as I look back over my life on the Johnson side, the Norwegian side, they're either massively obese or religious fanatics. And on the Houston side, trapped in there somewhere. But I like the effect of alcohol a lot better than I did religion. So you can tell the path I went down. But you know, I finished high school, I went to college, I damn near flunked out of college, I get drafted, get sent to Vietnam, and, you know, I never wanted to be an alcoholic, I wanted to be a disturbed Vietnam vet. And, God, I milked that one, you know what I'm saying? You drink too, right? You drink too. And, alcohol, you know, I've always been envious. If you read the history of some of the early members of AA, like you read about Dr. Bob, he does the first 8 steps, he has a major relapse. He comes back and in one day makes all of his amends. Well, that's because he lived in the same town. Alcohol took me to 7 states. I mean, first it took me to Oregon, it took me to Washington, it took me to Alaska, and then eventually took me to Colorado. And what I will tell you is this, the last 7 years that I drank was an absolute nightmare. And when I checked myself into treatment October the 19th of 1982, I weighed about 260 pounds and I had brain damage, kidney damage, liver damage. And everything I owned you'd put in a duffel bag and there wasn't anybody on the planet wanting anything to do with me. I'm not the kind of person who if a woman is in anymore. And the reason is very simple, is what the effect was. There's some lines in the big book that describe this better than anything I could come up with. See, too, that when I drink, it treats this. It's part of my spiritual illness, my unmanageability. It says, Mark's having trouble in personal relationships. Starting with myself, I can't stand to be in my own skin. See, I can't stand who I am. And when I drink and when alcohol works, I'm okay with Mark. When it works. And I can't control my emotional nature, and I'm afraid of misery and depression. I'm full of fear, and I feel useless, and I'm unhappy. And when I drank and alcohol worked, it treated that. You see, what I didn't know then is I suffered from a spiritual malady then. I suffered from a spiritual illness. And nothing outside of myself would treat that, but I didn't know. And finally, when I got sober, It's my life is so full of paradoxes, just much like the program. But when I got sober, I was working as an orderly in a nursing home. Now my head, my alcoholic crazed brain was telling me I was writing the great Jack London story. But you know what I was doing when I got sober? I was working as an orderly in this nursing home, and because of my size, there were 8 men in there who could virtually do nothing for themselves. And what I would do is these men, I would bathe these men on a daily basis, and I would put diapers on them. And that's what I was doing. And that's just another one of the paradoxes. I was almost dead in every way that you can be, but yet here's what God has me doing at that time. And I'm going to share 2 periods of time for me in AA, and then what I want to do is I want to come current with you. Because, see, you know, the big book talks about on your first visit with a man, give him this big book and ask him to read it. And in the interval, if he wants to see you again, what you must tell him is that the desire to find God must come from within. And if he wants to do that, you're willing to help him. And what I'm going to talk to you about is currently where I'm at in my life with seeking God, because that to me is what the steps are all about. This whole thing is about a relationship with God. At various times in AA, I have worshipped the fingers of AA instead of God. I've worshipped the big book. And all it is a set of tools so that I can develop an intimate, conscious, personal relationship with this power. But I'll tell you about my first 3 years in AA. You know, we tell people a whole bunch of things when they come into AA, and I was told all these things. I was told to go to a lot of meetings, and I did that. And I was told to read the big book, and I was telling someone earlier today, telling an alcoholic to read a book that's designed to transmit a spiritual experience, page manual, telling you to read it and go fly it. I'll tell you this, when you got ready to take off, I'm not going to be around. So you all told me to read this book. And you told me to go to a lot of meetings, and I did that, and I went to convention and did big book studies. And in that first 3 years, I asked 2 men to sponsor me. Some of what I'm going to talk about here is the things that I've heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, which I know today are not my truth based on my experience, that have nothing to do with this fatal illness. One of the first lessons I learned is if a blind man leads a blind man, you're both going in the ditch. And the first man I asked to sponsor me, we meet at Denny's. And I was probably about 6 months sober then, going to a lot of meetings, going to big book studies, reading the book. I overnight became a parrot. You know, I mean, it's about, you got to look good and sound good in meetings, right? If you're like me, I was telling a friend the other day, I was 3 years sober before the fear left me about getting up in the middle of a meeting to go use a bathroom. I mean, the fear was just incredible in me. But I asked this man if he would sponsor me. We meet at Denny's. In about 15 seconds, he took me through the first 3 steps. See, here is the bad news. I was in AA for 3 years telling you all I was an alcoholic, and you know what my truth is today? I didn't have a clue what that meant. God kept me sober in spite of that. But he said to me, are you an alcoholic? And one of the things that I've learned along my way in Alcoholics Anonymous is this, is when you ask me a question, there's a part of me called my ego that uses an answer today about the spiritual life, which is something I got to live. I can't theorize about. I need to sit with that and ask God to let me consider that, an open mind. But this guy says, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes. And you know, at that time, I think I'm an alcoholic because of the consequences of drinking. And I tell him, yeah. And he says, do you believe in God? And I tell him, yeah. Sometimes I think I've sponsored 2 atheists, and sometimes I think their concept of God is not anywhere near as confused as a whole bunch of us that come in here with a whole lot of other ideas. And we do a 3rd-step prayer in Denny's, and he gives me a few instructions on inventory, and I write this inventory, which is rather short in detail, and we do a fifth step, and I do six and seven, and that, and I come out of that with eight amends. Now, you got to understand, I lived in seven states. By then, I'd been married and divorced twice, numerous jobs, and my blood family's got more than eight people in it. I missed just a little bit in that whole process. A friend of mine said later, you were so wide open, you missed the whole thing. So I did the only right thing, is I figured the reason I... Because see, here's what goes on in me. The further you get away from a drink, there's a condition inside me. The book calls it spiritual malady, and this condition is internal, and you separate me from alcohol and you leave me untreated. This condition gets worse and worse and worse in me, and this condition's getting worse. I don't know what to call it then, though. I have that one, probably. And so this sponsor basically did the same thing with me. So here I am at 3 years sober. Now there's a tremendous confusion going on. I'll tell you why. Because in the first 3 years of my sobriety, I'd bought a home. And I had a job that was paying me about $50,000 a year. And I had a home group, and I had a bunch of friends in my life. But this condition I told you about, this unmanageability, which is inside me, is growing. It's getting worse, and it's getting worse, and it's getting worse. And I'm full of fear, and I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. And so that's about the time that I hooked up with Don P. Don was one of those guys that initially, you'd talk about the big book, and you'd talk about God, and there was a sense of power and peace around him. See, there was another thing I didn't know at that time. I didn't know that we agnostics describes two groups of people in AA sober. And one group, it says about one group that if they're willing to meet a few requirements, that they'll come to believe, and if they have a certain attitude, that the way they think and live will be revolutionized. Revolutionized. And it says it's happiness in a sense of direction. And it says this group has God as a central fact of their life. Well, I know today I didn't have God as a central fact of my life, because I'd never picked up the kit of spiritual tools, the steps to develop a relationship with God. And the other group I've already talked about. They're on page 52. They have trouble in personal relationships, can't control their emotional nature, prey to misery and depression, they're full of fear, can't make a living, they feel useless, they're unhappy. They have themselves as the central fact of their life. And that's where I was at. I used what words I could best explain to tell him where I was at. And see, the confusion. I got a bank account. I got two cars in the garage. I got a home that I bought. I'm married. I'm in a career. And I'm dying. And I know I'm real close to drinking alcohol. You see, I'm confused. And I'm going to a lot of meetings. And I'm reading the book. You see? I've also learned something else in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's two languages for me in AA. One is the language of knowledge, and the other is the language of experience. And here is another confusing thing. Every other area of my life, knowledge equals power. In the spiritual world, it does not equal power. The spiritual life's not a theory. I have to live this thing. I have to have an experience with this thing. I cannot conclude about God. One of my major defects for years was I loved to give you my opinion on experiences that I'd never had. And I asked God. And Don sat me down, and we turned to the title page of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. In about 10 minutes, I got a very, very clear picture of exactly what was wrong with me and what the solution was. And he took that circle and that triangle. And, you know, when we were given those three legacies, we were given recovery first. Because my primary purpose is to stay sober. If I don't stay sober, I'm not going to be going to meetings, and I cannot be of service. And he asked me what I thought that meant. And I'd been around long enough to be dangerous to myself and others. And I said to him, as one of the strange observation I noticed about myself, you ask an alcoholic a yes or no question, and 15 minutes later, they'll give you the final yes or no. We can't answer yes or no questions. We have been dishonest for so long, we've had to explain elaborately. You know, I mean, I love to ask a new alcoholic, you know, are you married? And they get a little glazed, and they just get ready for a long talk, you know. So I begin to pontificate with him. Have you ever gone from the title page to page 164 and done everything the book said? And I said, no, sir, I have not. I'll tell you something. The people that I have in my life today, they love me more as a child of God than they care about my sensitive feelings. And the people that I have in my life today, the men and the women, what I care about is you better be telling me my truth. That's the greatest form of love that you can show me. You better be more concerned about my life than you are about my feelings. And he taught me that. And that's the place I come from today. We love people to death in AA. We love them to death. So, I'm 3 years sober and discover that I'm not in recovery. And then he asked me what I thought unity was, and that's the fellowship, and of course I'm in that part of it. So he said, you're taking your body to your meetings. Uh-huh. So he talked about service, and he asked me what I thought that was, and ashtrays and coffee cups, and he laughed, and he did then, and he still does today. He said, Mark, if you are willing, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length, when you get to the 10th step, you will have entered the world of the Spirit, and you will take your awakened spirit out to be a service to God and your fellow human beings in every area of your life. And since you've never done that, you're not in that part of the program either. So let me explain, Mark, what's going on with you. A circle represents wholeness, at one, Mark, at one with God. He said, you've been in one part of a three-part program expecting the results of the other two. And I heard everything he said. See, what I know today and what I love about the steps out of the big book is the steps will speak to my spirit, the condition of my spirit. I don't care how long you're sober. I don't care how long you're sober. And I knew that everything he said was the truth, the journey. And I would like to tell you that I stayed involved in the spiritual program of action, but that's another key piece of something I want to share with some of you. There's another part of my being, and a man named Dr. Harry Tebold, who's written a lot of stuff on this, talks about what happened to me is from about 3 years sobriety to right around 8 years sobriety, my ego had begun to rebuild. I bought that. But here's what happened in the midst of it. There's a part of my being called my self-will, called my ego, that begins to rebuild, and there's absolutely nothing I can do about it. And very gradually and very subtly, I basically begin to pull away from my home group, and I begin to pull away from the people in AA, and I begin to be interested in a woman and making money and doing all those other kinds of things. And to make a long story short, and in June of 1991, I wound up in a nut house in Houston, Texas. I was in treatment in 1982, and I could look at alcohol and say, that's why I'm in this state, that's one thing. But when you're almost 9 years sober, and they lock you up in a nut house, and the guy does this thing with a smile. And Mark, I got the keys, and you ain't leaving till we tell you. I said to myself, Mark, you really missed some things here. What'd you miss? And I'll tell you something, I picked up that basic textbook, and I said to God, God, I've got an open mind, and I want some help. Because I'll tell you something. They wanted to tell me that I was in there because of Vietnam. I'm far enough removed from that to tell you that is not the truth. I was in there because I was dying of untreated alcoholism. 9 years sober, having had an incredible experience with these steps one time and with this power. I was dying of untreated alcoholism, my spiritual malady. And I almost took my life behind that. Now I want to try and bring you current. This is another lesson that I learned. My body today is not existing off the food that I ate last week. And this is my truth today. We finish every one of our meetings with the Lord's Prayer that says, give us this day our daily bread. And based on my experience winding up in that nut house, I begin to really look at the book, and I begin to see that the book gives me a severe warning. And I'll tell you what my truth today is. The arrogance of me to think that I could operate in 10, 11, and 12, and that's all there was, and go through that one time, it absolutely astonishes me. For me to think an inventory that I wrote 7 years ago and the truth that I saw in that inventory has anything to do with my life today was so arrogant of me. So since then, I've gone through the steps many times, and I will tell you this, the last 4 years of my life have never been so blessed, and I have never been so much at peace. Peace with God and peace with me and peace with you. So let me bring you current. In April this year, third week in April, with one woman and five men, my method is seeking a relationship with God. God is the most central fact of my life today. And that's why I work the steps. And so we sat down as a group, 9 o'clock in the morning, and we meditated for 20 minutes. And we asked God to come in, and we asked God one other thing. The very day that I want to have a new experience with God, because the 11th step says improve your conscious contact. Doesn't say rest on your conscious contact. The very day I choose to, my last experience and everything I think I know. So in that 20 minutes of meditation, I said to God, God, please, please free me from everything I think I know about you and my steps and my illness for an open mind, a new experience. For an open mind and a new experience. We got done with that meditation. We started in the title page. And we went through the forewords. And we got into the doctor's opinion. And here's what I looked at from the doctor's opinion to page 20. I looked at one thing. Mark, when you take a drink of alcohol, what happens to you? I'll tell you another thing I love about the big book. What the big book does is it takes everything that my ego wants to use to separate me from you, and it skims it all aside and says, Mark, we don't care about that. Here's what I mean. The big book doesn't care how young and old I am. It doesn't care if I'm a male or female. It doesn't care what my race. Alcohol, does a drink take you? And I looked at that, and I turned statements in the doctor's opinion into questions, and I discovered something else about myself. I'm so selfish. When the big book uses the word we, I think they're talking about you. So I put my name in there. Mark, is this you? Is this you? Is this you? And I'm looking at one thing only. Am I powerless over alcohol once I take a drink? And I have to go back into drinking. And I see why in 1978, when my grandmother died, who I loved immensely, and I got a phone call if there was she to leave. My experience is I drink if she stays and I drink if she leaves. But I heard this in meetings, Hulk, all the time. The day Fred picked up, posed a big deal in Washington, said he was a happily married family man. Fred, whether I drink alcohol again. I told guys I sponsor, if you buy that one, your only problem is you're going to weigh about 300 pounds. So that's another belief system that goes dancing away. Here's another one. Put the plug in the jug. Out of the jug. I don't have the power. That's an expression that refers to people who don't drink like me. Here is another one. Don't drink even if your gluteus maximus falls off. Your butt. Alongside my experience, and I would see that's not my truth. And as I begin to do work with the big book over and over again, I begin to realize I can't. Over and over again, these things that I've heard. Works at Intergroup in Houston, Texas. 1993, they gave away 33,000 desire chips. You know how many one-year chips they gave away in 1994? 3,000. That's an 8% recovery rate. This book promises 50% of those who come never relapse again. A few more relapse and come back, that's 75%. How did we get so far? How did we get so far? I think I have an idea how we got so far removed. When I sit down to work with another alcoholic, there's two things I always do. The first is we pray and we ask God to come in. Same way Chess opened this meeting. And the second thing is this book is always open between us. Because the book says, I'm to show you how I recovered from a hopeless state of mind, body, and spirit. I remember one time a man said to me, don't you ever be an accessory to murder. This is a fatal illness, and its solution is spiritual in nature. And this solution was given to us in 1939, Mark. Don't you ever play with somebody's life. And I don't. I carry this book everywhere I go with me. So I get done looking at that. I'm at the bottom of page 43, almost 13 years sober. Here's me. Mark, at certain times, has no effective mental defense against the first drink. My defense must come from God. And at that point in time, experientially, I once again see how badly and desperately I need God in my life. And then I start to look at the unmanageability in my life. And there's a paragraph on page 52 which sums that up for me. Here's my experience with unmanageability. It's not out-drink. It's the reason I'll drink again. Because the big book says, the symptoms of the body and mind, they're symptoms, Mark. Well, doctors don't treat symptoms. You got to treat the problem. So what's the problem? The problem is this spiritual illness. Guess what? No human power can treat a spiritual illness. Only God can treat a spiritual illness. So I look at myself right now today and I ask myself, where are you at in all these areas of your life, Mark? Are you having trouble in personal relationships? So I look at the relationship with myself. I look at every area of my life with myself and I look around me and yeah, I'm still having trouble. With the power, grace, love that God has given me up to this point in time, I'm having problems in personal relationships with some people. Can't control your emotional nature. How do you do things? Gee, I wonder why that happens, Mark. Says you're prey to misery and depression. Says you're full of fear. Mark, you having trouble with fear at times? Yeah.
Feel useless at times?
Yeah.
Can't help others at times? Yeah. And here's what I get a chance to look at. I get a chance to see this unmanageability in my life. Something outside of me will treat it. A woman, money, career, travel, brief periods of time. But ultimately, this thing stays with me. And now I've had an experience with step one to come up with one conclusion, and that is that I need to go seek power. I need another deeper relationship with God. And now I look at my second step. This is also my experience. When I'm sitting in meetings of AA and someone says I'm struggling with the fourth step, my experience is steps 2 through 12 are always about 1. Faced with writing an inventory to face and be rid of the things that have me blocked from the only thing that's going to give me peace and power and keep me away from alcohol. Faced with writing an inventory of drinking alcohol, writing inventory is like kissing a baby's butt compared to what I do when I drink. Myself one question. Make the amend, drink whiskey. If you're like me, making the amends very easy compared to what happens to me when I drink alcohol. My experience in steps 2 through 12, if I'm balking, it's not about that step. It's always about my truth in step 1. Big Book says, Mark, you're building a spiritual arch through which you walk a free man. The foundation of it all is my truth in step 1. Experientially, I know that I have an illness of body, mind, spirit, and no human power can treat. And you know, once I had that experience, I still remember from the first time, and it's no different today. Once I had an experience with step one, he's looking at me, my eyes are just, whoa! Because I saw my truth. After 3 years in AA, I saw my truth. I just saw my truth again. My only question to him was, how do I find the power? You think I'm going to debate at that point in time about God? No. I had one question. Big Book says, Mark, seek recovery with the dead-end meetings. And I hear people say, take your time. Take your time. Take your time. I suffer from a fatal chronic illness that is progressive in nature, and only relationship with a power greater than myself will treat it. And I need to do what the book says. Seek recovery with the desperation of a drowning man. So in my second step, two parts to it. Mark, you're willing to believe it'll take you into areas of your life, dimensions of your life, Mark, that you don't even know exist. Because I'll tell you something, for me and for every one of us in here, if this is the best it's ever going to get, then God isn't everything. He's limited. He's finite. And I open myself up to the idea that with God, being at one with God, He can take me into areas of my life I didn't have the power to have. You see, this is not everything and this is not all. I know there's more. I know that God can take me into other areas, deeper levels, in terms of that relationship with Him. But then I'm faced with a crisis. You know what it is? So I got to make a choice. God's everything or He's nothing. If lack of power is my dilemma, the book says, where and how are you going to find the power? And it tells me only one place, Mark, deep down within you. Now, that's another paradox. Hell, I did peyote on mountaintops with Indians and traveled all over Amarillo, Texas. It says in the final analysis, Mark, that's the only place you're going to find God. Isn't that interesting? But it also says, Mark, you got to be willing to search fearlessly. Are you willing, Mark, based on my truth in step one? Yeah, I was willing. And then I get up to those ABCs. And I ask myself experientially, is this you? Mark, are you an alcoholic that can't manage his own life today? Yeah. Mark, do you believe any human power can treat your alcoholism? No, I do not. Based on experience. Mark, you believe that God can and will if you seek Him? Absolutely. And so I know my responsibility. Mark, you willing to seek the power? Yeah, I'm willing to seek the power. And now I'm at step 3 and I get to make a decision. I was in AA several years before third step decision. Big Book said, here's the requirement, Mark. Are you convinced your life run and your will doesn't work? So I go back and that my life run and my will doesn't work, that at my very best I create confusion instead of harmony. It says, even when my motives are kind with you, I'm selfish. And I see that once again, and I once again experience my truth. And then the book gets to the part I don't like, and that's what's wrong with me, the root of my problem. Mark, you're selfish and self-centered. Is this you? Yeah. Mark, you're driven by fear, self. And every time I read that, I visualize this. It's like a limo pulls up in front of my house in the morning, okay? And I go out and get in. The driver turns around. He says, Mark, my name is Fear, and I'm going to drive your ass today. And he does all day long. I go into work, I know they're going to fire me. I walk into my home group, I know someone's going to say something to me that's going to hurt me. I mean, I'm just driven by it all day long. Or another day that I get in, the driver says, "Hi, Mark, I'm self-pity and I'm driving you today, buddy. And they ain't paying me enough and you don't treat me." I mean, over and over again. And then there's a line in there that says, "Mark, your troubles are your own making." You know what? AA did a couple things for me, and I balked a little at them. Here's one of them. You all said to me, "Mark, that was then and this is now, and buddy, you better grow up." You also did something else to me. This one I really didn't like. You basically said this to me. "See, most of my life what I did is I lowered my conscience to my behavior. I cheated on this woman because lower my conscience to my behavior. AA and God, you know what you all did to me? You really screwed me up. You said, 'Mark, we're going to raise your behavior to your conscience.'" Oh, no. There's no such thing as a white lie. A lie is a lie. And every time I violate my conscience, God, consciousness, consciousness. A friend of mine the other day, "I can't even do my mistake what I used to do on purpose." So my troubles are my own making, but here's the great news in that. That is a great statement of hope. Here's why. If my troubles are your making, I'm in trouble. Because what if you don't ever change or get any different? Thank God my troubles are my own making. Experience, and it's not about you. It's always about me, because my troubles are my own making. And then the book lets me look at something. It says above everything,